Wildfires in California have forced tens of thousands to leave their homes in a troubling echo of recent years.
Everyone I know is being affected in one way or another. The common denominator is prolonged stress, coupled with post-traumatic stress disorder, especially if they lost everything 2 years ago.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 29th, how Californians are coping with the ongoing threat of statewide fires. Also on the show, what Representative Katie Hill's resignation from Congress tells us about the post-Me Too moment in politics.
I think we are in a post-gender moment.
And a writer for HBO's Watchmen explains why superhero stories are such an effective avenue for tackling social issues.
When I started reading X-Men, for instance, when I was younger, I always saw it as an allegory for what it was like to be a minority.
And we start in California.
My name is Joshua Cohen. I'm calling from Archidis, California. I've had no electricity for about two and a half days, and many here in surrounding communities have lost hundreds of dollars worth of food. We obviously cannot charge our phones and other devices.
The stress level from living through the car fire and the campfire sure impacts us when we hear of these other fires going on.
This is Bonnie. I live in downtown Oakland. I'm relatively safe from the fires, but knowing that there are communities burning around me creates a constant sad foreboding. So every time I enjoy a beautiful autumn wind blowing against the bright blue sky, for example, I catch myself and remember that that wind has probably ignited more houses, traumatized more people and animals, and further scarred our world here in the Bay Area. I know these fires don't last forever, but while they burn, it's like living in a dystopian movie.
For days, wildfires have swept the state of California. In Sonoma County in Northern California, the Kincaid Fire has destroyed more than 120 structures and burned more than 74,000 acres. That's an area more than twice the size of San Francisco. We heard from you there at the top, and we'd love for you to keep sharing your experiences with the California fires at 877-8MY-TAKE, or you can tweet me at Tanzina Vega.
When I got to the beach, I got out of my car and I was just shocked that there was a smell of smoke in the air.
That's Maureen Flanagan. She's a registered nurse at Santa Rosa Memorial Hospital.
For there to be smoke smell at the ocean is really concerning. That's just so unusual. And it was my first clue that something was amiss.
And last week, she was one of the thousands of people who had to evacuate because of the Kincaid Fire. She went to the home of her friend Jennifer Laporta in South Santa Rosa.
I was just like, okay, I'm going home. My first priority was get my animals. There was a parade of traffic, wall to wall, just bumper to bumper traffic. So I came to her place in South Santa Rosa with my two cats in a crate together because I loaned my other crate to my other friend who didn't have a crate. So that night, I didn't get a lot of sleep because my emergency alerts were going off my phone all night long. So at 3 a.m., I woke up because of alerts, and I opened the door, and I'm like, great. At first, I was like, this relief because there's no evidence of wind. I'm like, great, the winds haven't picked up. And all of a sudden, the winds kicked up, and I have my van outside. My cats are in the van. I finally felt fear. I'd been pretty calm, and at that point, I'm like, I was scared.
As thousands of people evacuated the area, Maureen still had to report to work the next day in the midst of the growing fires.
It was just such a surreal moment. It just felt like the apocalypse because the traffic is just bumper to bumper, hardly moving, coming in the opposite direction. And I'm thinking I just have to get to work. Basically, I'm a first responder. I knew I had to go to work. There's people that have been there over 13 hours and I need to get there. I just decided I need to do it. So I drove in the other lane and I whipped out my RN badge and just was showing people that's why I'm driving on the wrong side of the road because I'm trying to get to work.
The hospital was short-staffed and there was a lot of confusion among the staff and the patients.
But what happened that really helped the day was people just started coming in. One of my coworkers came in at about 10 o'clock. She was nearby. She came in. She wasn't scheduled. We needed help. And it was just like such relief. I gave her a big hug. I'm like, oh my God, thank you so much for coming in. And then people started coming in. Within like 3 hours, we had enough staff.
Thank you, Maureen, and to the many of you in California who've been sharing your stories with us.
This is Kim Fuchs in Sonoma County. Everyone I know is being affected in one way or another. The common denominator is prolonged stress, coupled with post-traumatic stress disorder, especially if they lost everything 2 years ago. One gal I know just moved back into her rebuilt house 2 weeks ago, and now her neighborhood is under immediate threat again. She's relying heavily on support and mental coping techniques, but it takes its toll anyway. Most are without power. Many are sheltering in dangerous areas because they have beloved pets they won't abandon, and shelters won't take pets. Most shelters are full. It will be a time to hunker down in fear of weather reports and planned power outages and thoughts turning to what we call go bags by the door with essentials we need to save and to exit plans in case of evacuation. This is now our fate.
When fighting the Kincade Fire in Northern California, hot, dry winds, colloquially called Diablo winds, have made it challenging to combat the flames. James Gore has been watching that unfold in his county. He's the Sonoma County Supervisor for the 4th District, and he joins me now. James, thanks for taking the time in the middle of everything.
Hello from Ground Zero.
So how are you, and how are the evacuations going so far?
You know, I'm doing okay. Personally, I'm evacuated. I'm staying at my mother's place with my wife and kids, taking cold showers because the gas is out too. And it's not important what I'm doing. I'm safe. What's going on out around me? We still have, even though we repopulated 30,000 people yesterday, we had 185,000 evacuees, and that was an arduous task. But it was a needed action. And you know what it did? Is it allowed these firefighters to do what they do best and get in there and go after this thing. And it was damn inspiring.
James, how much time do people typically have when they have to evacuate in a situation like this? I mean, was this, you know, we know it's fire season, so I'm sure people are generally on alert. But how much advance notice did people get that they were going to have to leave?
Well, in this case, it was quite good. You know, if I look back 2 years ago, when the Tubbs, Nuns, and Pocket fires were burning in our October 2017 fire siege, you know, people didn't get the benefit of that. We did have a red flag warning, but I'll just say it openly is that we as a community had not embraced the new normal with the other side of the new normal, which is our preparedness, our response, our activism, our vigilance. So people were evacuated in the middle of the night with smoke and fire around them, and firefighters were not able to fight the blaze. And on the other side now is it was about 10 a.m. in the morning when we announced an evacuation, and we needed people out of those areas by about 4 in the afternoon. So I, just like all of my constituents, am also a resident in my own area. So I went and announced the evacuation and then went back out and prepared my house.
We had one listener who said she and her family weren't able to find accurate information about the evacuation. What's your response to folks like that who say that the government wasn't getting the information that residents needed in a timely manner?
You know, in this kind of a situation, practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes better. I've heard quite the opposite. I've been down at the shelters. I've been all over the place. And the alert and warning that went out not only for the evacuations on the night of, but all around the place, has been heralded as quite the opposite. But does that mean everybody gets the information? No. We live in an age of fragmentation of information sources. You know, I have my mother-in-law, for example, when we were having one of our power outages, she tends to watch either MSNBC or Fox News. So she doesn't get into the world of always local management, local issues. And so despite the fact that we push it out on every cell phone in the area, that's despite the fact that we have opt-in procedures and everything, and it's on every paper and everything that's going on, every radio show, there are people who are gapped, and we need to get in there and get them.
I want to talk for a moment here about PG&E, because on Monday, the company told the state regulators that their equipment might have caused at least three of the current fires. Their equipment is also suspected to be behind the Kincade fire. We know that PG&E has tried in many ways to turn off the power to avoid this. They're also dealing with bankruptcy issues and a bunch of other issues. What is their role in all of this, in your opinion, James?
Well, I have to give both credit and criticism where it's due, right? We have to be able to have this open and direct conversation. PG&E, they're a utility. We have to partner with them here. There's been good things they've done over this last power outage, but at the same time, they are liable for much of what's going on around here. But also, you got to look around at the land. You got to look around at all the vegetation that's ready to burn, and realize that in spite of whatever thing ignites it, we're sitting out here ready to burn right now. And since I've been elected as a county supervisor after leaving D.C. for a long time and coming back home, you know, I've experienced in 5 years historic drought, driest year on record in Sonoma County, historic flooding twice, wettest year on history of Sonoma County, catastrophic wildfires twice, and then some. So you got to realize that once again, while many people talk about the new normal in this fearful post-apocalyptic way, you know, we've been rallying over the last 2 years to be the point of the spear on preparedness and resiliency. And if you're in our community right now, you see that and you feel it and you taste it.
James, are there certain communities that are faring worse than others, that are more vulnerable right now to being unable to evacuate?
You know, the evacuations are going very well. So I wouldn't say on the last point is that are unable to evacuate. There are community members who are having issues, and that's where you get into the medical baseline, as PG&E calls it on their side. For us, we get into a larger portion, which is what we call access and functional needs, kind of this new menagerie, which includes everybody from my pregnant cousin all the way to somebody who has a CPAP and is, or somebody who's connected to a machine in some way. So that's really where it gets into on this evacuation side. With respect to where the fire is right now, we got a wind event that's starting right now at 6 a.m. and a red flag warning that's going to be pushing until tomorrow morning. So it's go time once again, and pushing a northeast wind pushing south. So the evacuated communities of Hillsburg and Windsor have taken their hits. We're a little bit more focused on actually, ironically, wickedly, and sadly, ironically, some of the same areas that were burnt where people have been rebuilding these last 2 years.
And James, last question quickly. Are the shelters still taking folks?
Shelters are still taking folks. We do have capacity. Thank people for their patience, because sometimes we have to move around and make that capacity expand. But, interestingly enough, only about 3 to 5% of people evacuated in any of these kinds of incidences go to shelters. So if you have 185,000 people evacuated, you got to swell up to about 10,000, 11,000, 12,000. And we did that in a matter of days, which is a feat in and of itself.
Well, James, thanks so much for your work out there, and good luck to you. James Gore is the Sonoma County Supervisor for the 4th District. Thanks for joining us.
Please wake up the world.
Further south in Los Angeles, more than 1,000 firefighters have been deployed to fight the Getty Fire. And that fire is over 600 acres big, and it's forced residents to evacuate the area. But the Getty Fire is not the only fire in the region. According to CAL FIRE, there are 6 other active fires now in Southern California, several of which have been contained. Jacob Margolis has been covering this, and he's a science reporter with KPCC. Jacob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So give us a sense for what we're seeing in LA, because the images, the videos that are coming out are pretty terrifying.
Yeah, you know what? There are a number of fires that have broken out in the region, and over the past week, it's been pretty overwhelming. The Getty Fire, which was right along the freeway and kind of stretched up into the hills where there are all these very fancy, nice homes, as well as the Getty Museum, was very alarming to see. It broke out at about 1:30 in the morning, and some people did not have any time to like get up and go and grab a bunch of stuff. They just had to leave as quickly as possible. And seeing that, and then strong winds pushed that through these mountainous regions that I think all Southern Californians really enjoy recreationally, not just living up there, you know, a few people living up there, is always really tough to see, because these fires could burn all the way to the ocean. That's what we saw with the Woolsey fire, I believe, last year. And it's tough to see. And air quality also becomes a major issue as well.
So what was the disconnect here? Was it that people weren't expecting the fires to go that far south? Was there a disconnect between, getting the information out in a timely manner? Why was it that folks felt that they were sort of leaving at the last minute without enough time?
I mean, because it breaks out right where they are, and then all of a sudden these winds, which are very strong and they're very dry, I mean, push those fires very fast. I mean, we saw with the campfire up in Northern California just how fast and deadly these blazes can be. And you know what? I mean, there are wireless emergency alert systems that go off there in California. There are police that will drive up and down these streets when they finally get the call and arrive at the location and use their loudspeakers and tell people to get up and get out. You know, it's a wild feeling. We had to evacuate recently for the Saddle Ridge fire. We weren't under mandatory evacuation, but the smoke was so bad we couldn't see down the street. And so we ended up leaving the area for a period of time. And regardless of if you have a heads up or not, you feel like your life is in chaos when all of a sudden you're like, I can't be at home. I can't be outside. I need to get out of the region. And for us, we were trying to escape, a region that's on fire up and down the coast.
So, Jacob, what are in terms of who's being affected by this, and also who's fighting these fires? I mean, where are the resources coming from to fight the fire? Because we're seeing oftentimes incarcerated men and women are sent out to fight these fires. There are private firefighter battalions that are often sent out. And then, of course, you have public resources. Is it a similar mix right now?
Yeah, you know, I've primarily seen for the Getty Fire, Los Angeles Fire Department, although I know LA County, Cal Fire gets involved, Ventura County gets involved. I mean, I saw Kern County come down and help with the Tick Fire in Santa Clarita last week. And so it's an all hands on deck kind of thing where these men and women are driving all over the state trying to help out. And I know there are resources that have come from out of state before as well. So it is an overwhelmingly large number of fires right now. However, honestly, compared to the last 5 years, if you look at Cal Fire numbers, we're still below average in terms of acres burned. That just goes to show you how bad the past 5 years have been, especially 2017, 2018, the most deadly and also the largest, burn years on record that we have.
We saw notable names, Arnold Schwarzenegger and LeBron James, have said they've had to evacuate their homes. But for the non-rich and famous in the region, how are evacuations going there? Where are people ending up? And are some people just unable to escape and having to shelter in place?
Yeah, you know what? When it's a mandatory evacuation, do not shelter in place. Like people need to leave. And there are some people that stay behind and spray their homes down with hoses. I have heard many times advisement, they just need to go because firefighters will handle what they can handle. And for people that can't stay at their homes, you know what? They have to. A lot of people go to hotels. When we left for Saddle Ridge, we had trouble booking a hotel. We found one for one night, then we had to drive like an hour or 40 minutes north to find another one for the next night. And I know that's been a problem for a lot of other people too. If you don't have the means for a hotel, there are evacuation centers that are set up, or if you just don't want to pay for a hotel, there are. And, you know, honestly, my wife and I are also talking about putting together a better camping kit so that next time something like this happens, maybe we could drive out of the region and camp for a couple days, because it's not feasible for us, you know, given how often these fires are, to be in hotels all the time, especially with kids. And I imagine other people are feeling the same way.
Jacob, you report on science. How big is climate change a factor in these fires? Because we've been talking about them now growing in intensity for the past couple years.
Yeah, huge factor. I mean, it's hotter, it's drier, and we're going to get these big flushes of rain that basically grow grass really high and then dry out in the fall. Fires aren't abnormal for California, but climate change is going to continue to make them worse, and people need to be aware and have all their emergency stuff together.
Jacob Margolis, stay safe. He's a science reporter with KPCC. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Monica. I'm calling from Venice, California. My son's school is closed. There is a site where people who have been evacuated can find other families that have extra space. I have several friends who have been evacuated, and another who was evacuated last summer is waiting to see whether she's being evacuated again. I am lucky enough to live in this community on the west side, but travel all over my city for work. I can't help but think of all the other communities that contend with life-threatening stress every single day, but get no support or even recognition for their struggles.
This is Peter Dumont from Berkeley, California. Even though I am living in beautiful, mild, temperate Berkeley, since Saturday we have had no internet access near where I live. And since last night, the smoky particulate in the air is really bothersome and worrisome again. What will it take to bring human society together in commitment to mutual goodwill, honesty, peace, and love for the things that really matter?
My name is Maria, and I'm calling from Venice Beach, California. My husband actually works at the Getty. He is one of the members that needs to be at the command center. We got that call around 3 a.m. that he needed to go in, and he has been sending me pictures and videos of what's going on at the Getty. He's saying that it smells really bad and he has to wear a mask. So it's pretty sad what's going on over there.
In 2018, Katie Hill was one of the challengers in California who unseated Republican incumbents in the House of Representatives, giving Democrats a majority in the House. But this Tuesday, just 10 months after taking office, Hill has announced her resignation from Congress. This comes after reports of an intimate relationship between Hill and a male congressional staffer, one she's denied. Hill has, however, admitted to a polyamorous relationship involving her husband, who she's in the process of divorcing, and a female campaign aide. Here's Hill in a video statement she released on Monday.
I never claimed to be perfect, but I never thought my imperfections would be weaponized and used to try to destroy me and the community I've loved for my entire life. For that, I am so incredibly sorry.
Meanwhile, multiple outlets have published nude photographs of Hill without her consent. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a statement praised Hill's contributions, but acknowledged, quote, errors in judgment that made her continued service as a member untenable. Pelosi continued, quote, we must ensure a climate of integrity and dignity in the Congress and in all workplaces. Joining me now to talk about all of this is congressional correspondent for The New York Times, Cheryl Gay Stolberg. Great to have you back on the show, Cheryl.
Thanks, Tanzina.
So remind us about Hill's standing in the Democratic Party before these allegations came out. Who was she politically?
Katie Hill was a rising star within the Democratic Party in the freshman class. She came to Congress in January of 2019, having defeated a Republican in the only conservative district in Los Angeles. So she flipped a seat, red to blue. And immediately, she drew the attention of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She became the liaison between leadership and the freshman class, and she was also given a very coveted position as vice chair of the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, which is a very, very important committee. It's central to the impeachment inquiry into President Trump.
Now, if you could just give us a brief overview of what the allegations are against her right now. There are multiple allegations.
There are really two central allegations. One is that she had a romantic relationship with a staff member, her legislative director, and that is specifically prohibited under House rules that were adopted this year in the throes of the Me Too movement. Members cannot have relationships, intimate relationships with subordinates. She has denied that. But she is also accused of having an intimate relationship with a campaign staffer who was several years her junior. And she has acknowledged that. And that relationship has been described as a thruple. That is a threesome with Katie Hill, the young campaign staffer, a woman. I should have said that the legislative director is a man. The campaign staffer is a woman. And also Katie Hill's husband, whom she's now divorcing.
There are also nude photographs of Katie Hill that have been published. And tell us a little bit about how she's responded to those.
There have been nude photographs that have been published, one showing her brushing the hair of the young woman, another of her appearing to smoke marijuana out of a bong. And she has said that these photographs are the work of Republican operatives and also of her husband, who she is divorcing and who she says was abusive and is trying to humiliate and destroy her.
There have been lots of talk about these photographs and what's known as revenge porn. What does the law say about the publishing of these of photos like this?
There are laws. There's a growing movement to ban what is called revenge porn, and that is non-consensual pornography, pornographic pictures or explicit photographs published without the person's consent. And in California, where Katie Hill is from, there is a law saying that revenge porn is illegal. So Congresswoman Hill has referred these photographs to law enforcement authorities, specifically the Capitol Hill Police, for investigation to see where they have come from. And her lawyers have filed suit against a British publication, the Daily Mail, seeking to have the photographs taken down.
It's hard to ignore the fact that the first member of Congress to trigger these new rules that were written in the Me Too era is a woman. Do you have any thoughts on that, on how that's playing out?
Well, a woman and also a bisexual woman, I guess I would just say it is worth noting that these rules, which were essentially passed, I think most people would say with predatory men in mind, have been used to push a woman out of Congress, a bisexual woman. An ethics investigation has been opened into Katie Hill's conduct. But that said, I think we are in a post-gender moment. We do know that women can be perpetrators of sexual harassment or sexual misconduct. Men and women must both be held accountable for their actions.
To that point, Cheryl, we've seen Katie Hill is not the first person in Congress to ever have been accused of sexual misconduct. She, however, has stepped down within 10 days of the allegations becoming public. How does her timeline compare to other cases of sexual misconduct in Congress, particularly those perpetrated by male members of Congress?
I think she probably quit a lot faster. I can think of a number of cases. John Conyers, the congressman from Illinois, who actually recently died at age 90, was accused of sexual harassment by multiple aides and ultimately stepped down. Another congressman, Ruben Cahun of Nevada, allegedly harassed a campaign aide and he also stepped down. Yet we have a current sitting congressman, Duncan Hunter of California, who is accused of using campaign funds to pay for an intimate relationship with a woman other than his wife. And he's actually indicted on misuse of campaign funds, and he's still serving.
And of course, rounding this out, you know, we started the segment talking about how Katie Hill flipped this seat to the Democrats. What do you see for the future of this district and whether or not Democrats will be able to hold on to it?
Well, it will be a tough fight, as it was for Katie Hill when she flipped the seat. But that said, I believe the Cook Political Report, which analyzes House races, has said that this seat is now slightly Democratic. I'm not entirely sure what the rules are for replacing her. It's possible that there will be a special election. I don't think that has been settled yet.
Well, we'll be watching and waiting. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Cheryl, thanks so much.
Thank you.
HBO's Watchmen is a TV sequel to the iconic graphic novel by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons. The show premiered earlier this month, and while many viewers may have expected action-packed vigilante justice similar to the 2009 film adaptation of Watchmen, the show is surprising some with its meditative look at race relations in 2019. Regina King stars in the new series as a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
I got a nose for white supremacy, and he smells like bleach.
Her character is tasked with bringing down a white supremacist terror organization known as the 7th Cavalry. The new show's first episode opens with an intense recreation of the 1921 Tulsa massacre, in which hundreds of black residents were killed and injured by a white mob.
I was familiar with the massacre. I was sort of taken aback by how many people hadn't heard of it. So it makes me very, very happy that we did that, just to enlighten a lot of people about an important element of American history.
That's Cord Jefferson, one of the writers on Watchmen. And I spoke to him about mapping out the show's first season and what he's hoping the adaptation will mean to viewers.
I was excited to write for a show that was set in Tulsa, simply because so many prestige television shows are set in New York and Los Angeles or other big coastal cities. And so working on a show about African Americans set in a place like Tulsa, where you don't really ever see prestige television set, was an exciting opportunity for me.
The relationship that Black Americans have with law enforcement in the United States has always been a difficult one. And I think over the past decade in particular, we've become more aware of that because of social media and videos that we've seen and the deaths of Black Americans at the hands of police, whose names we all know at this point. But how do you sort of turn that on its head here by making Regina King and others law enforcement?
One of the criticisms that I've seen of the show is about this very question, and is about the fact that we are not only having a black police officer as lead, but that she is battling a white supremacist organization. And very frequently in America, in American history, white supremacists have been police themselves, and there's been Klan members in the police force working hand in hand with Klan members outside of the police force. And so it rings as false and maybe offensively false to people to say that we are now with the police force that's battling the elements of white supremacy. And I would say that I think that's a reasonable criticism, but I would also say that it's still very early in the season, and I would suggest that people continue watching, because right now only 2 episodes have aired. And I think that a lot of those questions and concerns will be responded to as the season progresses.
Do you think exploring issues of race in this country, particularly today, through essentially what is a superhero story, does that lessen the message at all, or does that make it more accessible?
I don't think so. When I started reading comic books, when I started reading X-Men, for instance, when I was younger, I never took it to be a story about mutants with superpowers. I always saw it as an allegory for what it was like to be a minority or an oppressed person in society, an outsider. To me, the story of mutants and that kind of thing was just, you know, a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down, and that the X-Men were actually sort of, in my mind, always people of color or gay people or women or other oppressed members of society. And so I think that if you're looking at comic books the way that I've always looked at comic books, I think that they are much more important than you necessarily think they're going to be. Just because children read them doesn't necessarily mean that there's not important lessons to be learned within comic books. And so I would hope that simply because we're talking about superheroes and this the source material for this is a comic book, that people wouldn't think that we're belittling how important race and racism are in American society.
There are some folks who have criticized this because they say it politicizes one of their favorite comic stories. I mean, have comics really been able to avoid politics? And is that just terminology for we don't feel comfortable because it's talking about racism directly?
I think that all comic books have been largely political over the years, but I think that to say that we are politicizing Watchmen is a woeful misunderstanding of the original text, if you're a person who says that. I think that there's no way to look at Alan Moore's original Watchmen, which is a story about nuclear tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union, and vigilantism and police authority and Nixonian politics. How you can look at that and say that 35 years later we are injecting politics into Watchmen just seems like what you're saying instead is that our politics are not as palatable as the original politics of the text. And so if you're saying that for some reason you're finding the politics of our show to be less palatable for you, I think that sort of a person should do some soul searching and ask themselves why they think that the politics of the book are fine for them and the politics of the show are repellent to them.
You've worked on a lot of other shows, from The Good Place to Succession, which has become a cult favorite for better or worse there.
Yes.
I mean, what's your approach when you're looking at tackling current events as opposed to working in drama and comedy? I mean, Succession is quite a fascinating view of the uber 1%, and yet it has gotten quite a bit of attention. The Good Place is obviously comedy and not based in reality. So how do you kind of approach those different things? Do you pull from what's happening every day and in everyday reality into those stories?
Yeah, I think that The Good Place, despite being a pretty high concept, wild afterlife show, is grounded in reality in many ways and is grounded in actual emotion, and the characters feel real and the characters feel three-dimensional in a way that I think helps make it seem less crazy. For all the cartoony elements associated with The Good Place, I think that a lot of it is just about human connection and trying your hardest to be a good person and trying to figure out how to live a good life when you're here on Earth and not in the afterlife. And so I feel like those are very universal themes that a lot of people can latch on to. So I think that it's not, despite it being kind of crazy, it's not too easy to ground it and make it feel relatable. And I feel like Succession is a little bit too real. I think that Succession came along at exactly the right moment in American history when people are starting to really be deeply skeptical of uber wealthy billionaires. And when we're having such a huge, important conversation in society about whether billionaires should even exist. And so I think that is obviously much, much easier to consider relatable nowadays than The Good Place. But I do think that the thing that unites both of those things and hopefully the thing that unites everything that I work on is just universal themes of what it's like to be a human being and explorations of the human condition.
Cord Jefferson is a writer on HBO's Watchmen. Cord, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And that's our show for today. At the top of the hour, we heard from listeners in California about their experiences dealing with fires across the state. And to our California listeners, we want to keep hearing about how the fires are affecting you. So give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.